Hello, and welcome to the On Farm Trials podcast. We at the PNW Farmers Network are excited to have you join in for Season 2. To hear more about on-farm trials with soil health and cropping systems innovation on the dryland grain farms here in the inland Pacific Northwest. Listen in to hear from producers in the region, collaborators, and the stories of trying things in the field. If you like what you're hearing, please do tell a friend. We hope you enjoy another season of the On Farm Trials podcast. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Carol McFarland.
Today, we're on Starvation Farms outside of Lexington, Oregon, with Chris Rausch.
Hello.
Andre Rausch.
Hello.
And Leon Luna.
Howdy.
Great. Would you guys share a little bit about yourselves, your farm? And I think this is most of your farm team, but anyone else you farm with?
So it's a family farm started by my great-grandfather, Chris Mink. And then it went down to my grandfather, Julian Rausch, and then my father, Irvin Rausch. And then he retired and died in the same day, so then I took over.
Oh, man.
And so I farm with my son, Andre, my son-in-law, Leon. My daughter is also involved, Natalie, and my wife, Kathy, are all involved. And that's pretty much the farm partnership.
Great. Thanks for a little bit of the history there, too. Yeah. Sounds like quite the farmer retirement, though. Well, I see you have a good succession plan. Would you describe a little bit more about your farming conditions down here in the Lexington area?
So in Morrow County, we're mainly a Ritzville and Willis and Morton soils, 9-inch rainfall. We also farm in Umatilla County, about 12-inch rainfall, mainly from Rue Elevator up to Pendleton Airport in that area. So 3 inches makes a lot of difference. I grew up with a PhD in how to stop sand blows. So that got pretty dry and windy down here. It's a PhD I was glad to give up when we went into no-till. So we did that about 22 years ago.
Great. Thanks for sharing a little bit about that history. And it sounds like there's some embedded farm management goals, which we'll get into in just a minute. Would you guys talk about if you have a standard crop rotation and what that's like?
You want to answer that?
Sure. Wheat fallow primarily. Being in 9-inch rainfall, it's hard to do much else. We've tried to intensify that somewhat, and we do recrop spring wheat here and there, or recrop spring barley. And recently we've tried out camelina and safflower, and there's some promise to camelina. So we're continuing to expand that, and possibly in the future going with the rotation of camelina, winter wheat, camelina, summer fallow. So you get four crops in a six-year cycle versus three. But primarily today we're winter wheat, summer fallow.
Great. And it sounds like you have sandy soils, so maybe you're not storing as much?
They're pretty sandy down this way. Umatilla is a lot more clay, but yeah, they're pretty light. You have to watch how you work them.
Thanks for sharing a little bit about that. Seems like your terrain is a little bit different than some of the Palouseier stuff.
We're not hillland farmers. We're flatlanders, yeah. I mean, we have a few canyons, but it's nothing like up there.
Okay, so you can skip that extra premium hillside leveling package.
Yeah. It gets a little hairy in a few places, but we can manage.
All right. Great. Well, let's dive into talking a little bit about some of your management goals and, you know, how they might be different across the whole farm or by year or by field, and how that plays into some of the things we'll talk about with your trials.
Well, we're mainly a no-till, like I said before, and we're in a Kim Fallow rotation. And we've been doing that since we started 23 years ago. And we've gone into more of split as far as fertilization. We're splitting that more and more all the time instead of all out up front. That's one of the things we've changed over the years. We've changed over like what we're looking at in the soil as far as micronutrients. We've added a lot more of those. We're getting more in depth on those. Our rotations as far as crops, so we've got basically about 70% white, 30% red, sometimes 40% as far as that goes. We've added a lot of technology over the years as far as what to do things with and map things. Like my son said, we're starting to add more diversity to it a little bit. Some of its cereals. I've done oats in the past too, triticale. I used to do my own when he was a little boy. He doesn't remember all the work I went to, but I had my own test plots then of a whole bunch of different alternative crops, from lentils to millet to different cereal grains, barley. I'm trying to remember the one out of Australia. Lupins, sunflowers. I've tried all those, and I wished I kept all the notes I had on those, because that would have helped right now, because what we're doing now.
Mm-hmm. So what's been driving your interest in trying these things?
A couple of things. The soil health issue, looking at that. I've seen how things have changed in our soils over the years, how we used to do things. I remember putting on 100 pounds of anhydrous per acre. Now we're down into liquid. We just went from there to dry to liquid. And instead of doing that much, we're down into 20, 30 pounds of liquid fertilizer. So that's changed. The economics is another big one. Pretty much everything's driven by the economics. It's like, how do we either cut our cost and still grow the same, or how do we get more out per acre? It's a return on investment when you get down to it. And now it's either, we're trying to look at how do we get more out per acre? Can we add more on a 9-inch rainfall? Can we increase that rotation, and what fits? And that's been an off and on struggle to figure that out. Because I've cut 2 bushel wheat and I've cut 80 bushel wheat off of this place. So it's a big, big variance, and trying to figure that out, what works economically on that, gets to be a little fun.
2 bushel wheat?
Yeah.
I bet that wasn't a very nice day.
I didn't want to cut it, but Dad said cut it. So we cut it.
Yeah. How about, how do you see some of the management goals that are underlying your trials, Andre?
I think getting away from fallow in any way would be a good goal. It's really hard to do in our area, but anything that can help intensify that rotation and actually creating a real rotation. Winter wheat, summer fallow is not really a rotation. It's the same crop over and over again, but finding something that does provide some more diversity, but also pencils out. And there's a reason everyone grows winter wheat, summer fallows, because they have to buy a $500,000 combine and put a $100,000 header in front of that. So you gotta buy and grow what is going to keep you going. But I do think that there's other ways and more diversity that we could add and still make ends meet.
Leon, what's your, I know you're new to the farm team. Did you grow up in a farm, Leon?
No, I grew up in a trucking family. So as far as hauling all the wheat down to the river, I'm pretty good at doing that. Uh-huh. I let these guys kind of decide as far as diversity goes. And I'll give some of my input, but it's mostly up to them right now because I'm still learning everything from scratch, basically.
It sounds like you do still play an incredibly important role, just that the transportation, without that, it doesn't make it out of the field, does it?
Well, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Especially when we have a truck burn up in the field, fully loaded.
Oh, no.
We had that happen a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Well, it's part of it, I guess.
Yeah.
He does, Intertech, ask some really good questions. And there are things maybe we've had, already had this, Andre and I've had these discussions years ago over the same thing. So he's learning. So he's asking the right questions. That's a plus.
That's great.
A lot of them, the questions that I've been asking are like, can we do this? Can we do that? And he's like, already done it. Doesn't work. I'm like, well, I'm trying.
Yeah. Andre, I probably should have put this in a little bit earlier, but how was it to grow up on the farm? Watching your dad do some different stuff, maybe?
It was good. It's the only thing you know. It's normal. Everything's normal to you as you're growing up. You don't realize that it's kind of a hassle to drive 30 miles to the grocery store because you've always had to do that. And then when you have the convenience of being able to walk to a grocery store, it's like mind-blowing. So it gives you a different perspective, and I'm glad that I had that growing up. I always loved raising animals, having cows, and chickens are my favorite animal, and being able to have those just run around out front are great. And I don't think you really appreciate what it is to farm until you're actually doing it. So growing up on a farm and farming are vastly different things. And there was a lot that I didn't know until I actually came back and started doing it firsthand.
Great. Now, when did you come back?
2019, 2020, that cropping year. So this will be my fifth or sixth harvest.
I bet that was a really interesting time to be coming back to the farm. Did you guys get some drought conditions kind of subsequently?
Well, it's kind of normal.
Yeah. It's true, right?
Yeah.
I feel like 21
was. It was 21. Yeah, it was my first complete full year. It was the worst year ever that the farm ever had, at least agronomically.
Except maybe that two bushel wheat year. I don't know. That sounded pretty grim.
Yeah. We used to recrop more and there were some. I remember cutting all day as a kid one day and never dumping. I just went to dump for fun. The great combine never got full.
Mm. So do you have cows and chickens now?
No, I live in town now.
I got to just be like a little bit nosy into the background, but what did you do before you came back to the farm?
I worked in IT for Daimler, the trucking company, the largest commercial vehicle manufacturer in the world. And so I worked in the Daimler Trucks North America division of Daimler on their websites.
Oh, cool. Okay, so now anything that goes wrong with anything computer on the farm, is that you?
I'm the IT expert of starvation. Taking that over.
Any sort of new technology, he's also the one.
And there's a lot. There's a ton. And it's constantly evolving on the farm.
Well, that's great. I mean, it sounds like you really add a valuable contribution in that space. And actually, as you repeated the farm name, it makes me really want to know a little bit about the history of the farm name Starvation Farms.
So my father came up with the name back in the 70s, kind of what it was. He made it official in the 80s, but there were times it was really starvation. And there was a ridge out here. At one time it was kind of called Poverty Flats, and he kind of used that. And I remember him telling the story. I was much younger. I didn't realize how broke we were and how close we were to losing the place in the 60s and stuff.
Sounds like that's the difference between being a farm kid and actually farming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they kind of grew out of that. I mean, he had one bank. It was First International Bank at that time, or First National Bank is what it was called at the time. There are no more. And it basically told him, you either get out or get bigger. And a guy told him, we suggest you get out. And said, so he went looking and he got in with, it's now AgWest Credit. At that time it was a federal land bank or something like that, PCA. And they funded him and he had a crop failure. But they said, we'll stick with you. He had another crop failure. They said, we'll stick with you. And then things started to turn around. And in 1973, we actually started getting bigger finally. Things turned around over that four-year period before that, and bought out my cousin, we had and almost doubled the size of the farm in that 1 year, probably about 70-80%. And things have been kind of going okay since then.
I'm glad you're not quite as flirting with starvation, true to the name, hopefully not too much these days. You know, one of the things that I noticed in you talking about some of the things that you tried maybe a little while ago, you were talking about exploring diverse crops. What crops did you like? What really stands out? And if you think anything about the farming conditions are different now that might change what could or make something maybe worth trying again?
Well, what pushed that in the first place was clear back in the 2000 or whatever it was when the first direct seed conference happened. And we were looking to kind of head that direction. And I remember the conversation with all the growers is, one, can we grow different things? And what kind of drill do you use? Nobody knew. We're all new to this. And Dad was always kind of forward thinking. And he pretty much encouraged it. And we went out and bought a drill. He wasn't ready to go whole hog yet.
What drill did he buy?
We bought a 30-foot John Deere 737 drill with a 770 air cart. I might have the number wrong on that. I can't remember. Is what we bought. And then we turned around used it that fall and then turned around and spent the whole winter redoing it to something totally different, 33 feet, really big. And we weren't 100% no-till then, but we were still trying to figure out how to do Kim fallow yet. So one of the things that caught my eye, though, was can we do different crops? And so I started setting up my, they might have been 2-acre plots at that time, with this 33-foot drill, which was a lot easier to do plots of that size. And I started trying different crops. And I listened to Dave Shelton was one I talked to a lot on things they were trying. I forgot who he was working for at the time. Works for Alvaugh now. But he was kind of a cropping specialist guy. And so we worked on, I tried using some of the stuff he came up with, and we tried different crops on recrop during drought years. Needless to say, none of it worked very well. But we learned, and then we also learned how to do Kim fallow through all that, because at the same time we were trying to figure Kim fallow out. And we were spending $70-$80 an acre just in chemicals. And I remember Dad complaining about the chemical bill and that. And he says, well, it could grow jugs. And he was right. They could have grown jugs out there. But through all that process, we learned how to cut our cost, how to grow things. It took a few years, but that's what kind of drove that. Economic-wise, eventually it just got better and better. As we learned more to get better at it, we were still in the transition after a few years. Part of the ground was still conventional fallow and part wasn't. And it was an interesting shop conversation one time, I'll just put it that way, between family members. Do we go whole hog, no-till, or not? And it was split, and it was rather heated split.
Hopefully no wrenches were thrown.
It was close. It was very close. Anyway, we just kept progressing along, and eventually we got to 100%, and even the part of the family that wasn't happy about it came around and, this is pretty nice.
What did they like about it? What did they see?
It was a lot less time to farm, a lot less repair work. You aren't on a rod weeder 24/7 trying to fix that dang thing. That's not fun. The seeding was a lot better. We could do our fertilizing and seeding at the same time. Spraying was much easier, and we by that time we were getting the cost somewhat down. We've gotten better since then even. So it was kind of a time thing, but also the money. We were putting less out. So, and then no sand blows. And the soil was changing. You could kind of see it.
Can you tell me more about that? Especially since you have a sandy soil, I'm interested to know if accumulation of organic matter has kind of happened.
It has gone up to some. Now, we don't check it very often. I probably should, the correct way. But it was going down, and our pH was going up. And then when we started switching things, it took a few years, but the pH started to come down some. And the organic matter came up some. It wasn't a lot. I mean, we're in a low organic matter area anyway. You know, 1% is kind of where it's at.
That's where you can, you know, if you get a little bit, it feels like a big gain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what you saw in the soil, you could walk across the soil and even feel it just walking across it. Now, that's not a true measurement, but it was getting softer. What I really noticed in conventional fallow down here, there's two things that really stand out. Is the top moisture. Now, in Kim fallow, it dries out more, but it takes a lot less rain to wet that up so you can seed it. In conventional fallow, you might have that 4 to 6 inches of fluff, but a quarter inch rain ain't going to do it. It's not going to get it soaked up. The other issue was crusting. This is a very crusting soil. So you could go out there and seed, and stuff might be coming up, but then you get a rain on it. On conventional fallow, and you have an eighth to a quarter inch crust on top, it's like concrete. That stuff can't come through. It'll just grow right up, grow like an accordion, or go sideways. And I've had experience where I seeded out there after, and we'd been in 5 or 6 years, maybe at least, maybe a little longer than that. And we got a half inch to an inch of rain that night, and I'd seeded. Oh, crap, we're going to have to redo this. But I watched it, and I dug around. I could kind of tell by digging, like, this might be all right. And sure as guns, a few days later, stuff just popped through, no problem at all. So I don't worry about crusting anymore. In fact, in this area, on this part of the farm in Morrow County, probably 7 out of 10 years, we're just dusting it in. We'll wait as long as we can, but we're dusting it in October, usually by October 10th. And when the rain comes, I don't have to worry about crusting or anything. It's going to come.
So, Andre, do you remember this heated conversation in the shop? Where you
heard no, luckily, no, yeah,
he wasn't there. Around.
As long as I can remember, it's been no-till. I have a faint memory of being on a rod weeder when I was very, very young. But, yeah, it's pretty much been my entire life.
I asked you about your first no-till drill. What are you guys running now?
So we've got two. We've got, in Morrow County, we run a John Deere 1830 hoe drill, 10-inch space, with like a paired row, like a 3-inch paired row or 4-inch paired row. And it puts the seed down on each side and then the fertilizer's below that. And in Umatilla County, we have a pillar drill, 10-inch spacing. They call it a, trying to get the right name.
Disco. It's a 40-10 DH, 40 feet, 10-inch spacing disco drill.
So what it is it's like a deep furrow disc drill. It doesn't disturb as much than the hoe drill, but it's more than just like a single or double disc drill. And it'll still put the seed down low, the fertilizer down low, and then the seeds up on a shelf above it off to the side. And it'll handle 100 bushel stubble. No problem. I mean, it didn't start out that way. We had to found out there were some adjustments we had to do to it, but it'll handle 100 bushel stubble now. And it's pretty good. I wish it was 50 foot up there, but.
Yeah, the pillar drill works a lot better if there's a little bit of moisture. If there's a light fluff on top of the soil, which is kind of our conditions a lot of the times in September, it can kind of mound the back row. And so it's kind of condition dependent, but if you have the right conditions, the pillar drill can go through any stubble and it just makes a great, it does really well.
Can I ask a little bit more about the modifications that you did to make it go through that stubble?
There was actually an update there. If you got, they call it residue, I forgot what the term was, residue, like a residue rubber flap in front. And apparently they've made an adjustment to that. It's pretty minor. And we had the wrong ones. And the owner of the company talked to us, and we brought this in during COVID. And so they weren't able to give us all the owner, the sales help they needed.
To teach us how to use it, really. Yeah. We kind of learned on our own, and we didn't learn everything properly.
And so we put those on. They sent us a whole bunch of new ones. It was like night and day, a whole new drill.
Yeah, it was a tiny change. It just changed the angle of this guard that protected the disc, but that made all the difference in the world. We were plugging up occasionally before in like 60 bushel stubble, and then we put these guards on a different angle, and you wouldn't think it would make much of a difference, but that year we seeded through. I mean, parts of that were probably 20-inch stubble, 120 bushel wheat that we seeded through, and no problem, and no plugging. It made a huge difference.
Sometimes the little things are the big things.
Right, yeah. It's like a 20-degree change on a shield, that's all it was.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that, you guys. Well, let's dive into a little bit more of the experiments that you have going on the farm right now for this season. What are you looking forward to watching?
You want to talk about the brawl?
We have a few things. One of them is, and we've worked with this before, that Advancing Eco-Agriculture, John Kemp's company, using some of their products in lieu of conventional products. And we had really good results in 2022 when we did a field in AEA, and then we never did it again because I don't know why. Yeah, it was too good. So this year we took one field and we split it in half. It's a 500-acre field, and half of it we didn't have any seed treat on. We used their non-conventional, non-pesticide seed treat.
One's a biological. Yeah. Well, yeah. Maybe they both. No, one's biological, one isn't.
Yeah, there was a liquid and a dry that we applied to the seed. And going forward, we're going to continue using non-conventional products as foliar applications. And we'll be able to see on a large scale what difference it makes. Other than the seed treat and the fertilizer and the foliar applications, everything else will be the same. It's the same variety in the same field side by side.
Okay, so it's a split field sort of design?
Yeah, it's a big square field, and half of it's 250 acres on one side and 250 on the other. split between the two practices.
Great. And then I guess when you have something like that, I don't know if you have a general plan that you kind of follow, or what do you watch throughout the year? Where's your report card? What data matters to you?
Well, Nat, we'll kind of go with their recommendations. We'll follow what they're doing. One of the things, and this is one of the reasons we didn't come back to it right away, was the sampling you have to do and the management. And when we started this, I wasn't much help because I just had heart surgery.
Oh.
So the sap sampling takes a lot of time. And we weren't quite ready to develop that much, spend that much time on it, but we're going to try it again. So we'll just take the sap samples and we'll take their recommendations of what to put on it. And it's their regenerative ag practices. And the other part, we'll just use our conventional things we've been doing. And, kind of see what happens from there. We'll keep track of what we've done and see if there's a difference in yield or protein or how it works out.
Yeah.
And then cost. He's a numbers guy, so he's got a spreadsheet for everything. So
yeah, no, we'll look at the cost for sure, but then also the yield map's probably the biggest measuring stick we have at the end of the year is, well, if can we see it on the yield map? And then, and that'll drive everything.
So one of the things, if you guys are flatlanders here, it seems like you might have an easier time with consistent or relatively consistent field conditions. I know doing research on the Palouse especially, you have to kind of lean into this blocking in order to get statistically valid results, because you just could never find one flat homogeneous space for repeatable results.
Yeah, I wouldn't say ours are homogeneous either. There's definitely differences in soil depth, but probably more so than in the Palouse.
There isn't a lot of difference between the soil types. So one of the programs I'd signed up for was sampling by soil types and stuff. And I just, over the years when I did it, there wasn't a lot of difference. There's some difference in parts of the field. There's really shallow soils. But as far as Richville and Willis or Warden and stuff, the depths are pretty much mostly the same. The differences are minor. There are differences. You'll see it in the yield map, but they're not huge over the whole field. So we can make minor adjustments instead of having to go grid sample and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you're able, it seems like that kind of paired comparison. Again, you're representing pretty comparable field conditions.
Yeah, more or less. And I think we have a large enough area where we're not going to get certain anomalies because there's a tiny... And I think we've had that in the past where we've done a test and it's like it may have looked really well, but then you could have put it on just that one spot of ground that was actually a little higher producing. And so there are maybe 10 to 15% differences, and even in a flat homogeneous field. And so spreading that over 250 acres, we're going to kind of, law of averages is going to work its magic on that.
Now, when you put out a trial, do you put it on your best ground or your somewhere in the middle?
We don't put it on the worst ground, but it's probably in the middle. We just pick a spot that works.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't want to use our worst ground because almost nothing grows there. So, but, yeah.
It's only the stuff you really want to test its resilience.
Yeah. Yeah. Real good test.
Did you put your camelina up there?
We're going to this year.
Yeah, we are. We're doing some this year. Yeah.
Okay. So that's another trial that you've got going on this year is some camelina.
Yeah. It's our second year with it. We're expanding. So last year we only did 20 acres or 15. We are intending to do more, but we did a soil assay before we seeded. And camelina is especially sensitive to sulfentrazone, and we had residual sulfentrazone from spring 2 years earlier. And the soil assay made it look like the camelina wouldn't grow at all. But after we seeded it, it actually did just fine. So this year we're expanding. We're doing 120 acres. We're doing it on recrop primarily, and that's where we think it might fit into our rotation. It might even work a 9-inch rainfall in a recrop area, and the economics of it are pretty good compared to wheat at the moment. But we're also trying it on fallow, just where the wheat market was earlier. It's gone up somewhat recently, but the economics of camelina even on fallow looked better than winter wheat. So if it can work on fallow, that's another opportunity. Just for diversity, and as long as you know, if the economics look good on fallow, then I would even do it on fallow. But so we're trying both ways.
And we're trying two different varieties this year. So side by side on both sides of that. So kind of get under gauge and what's difference in the varieties.
Yeah. Oh, do you have the duct tape ready for your combine?
Yeah, we got through that last year. There was a lot of holes in our combine by the end of the year last year, but luckily we cut the camelina early before the holes developed. That is a challenge, just cutting it. It was very slow. We were actually able to get it decently clean. We were on a John Deere S780, and we had to play with it a lot, but we got it under 8% form. We were around 7 to 8% form material, and anything under 10% is acceptable to them with no dockage. So, yeah, we were pretty happy with that.
It looks like 50 when you're looking at it.
Yeah, it doesn't look clean in the bulk tank, but it was. And you're going about 1.5 miles an hour, which is a challenge if we ever did get to scale up camelina. And that's something, you know, in our area, is everything's done at a very large scale because we're at 9-inch rainfall. You have to have a lot of acres. And so anything we do has to be scalable, you know, over thousands of acres. And that's one of the logistic problems with the camelina, is the speed at which we would cut it would take an extremely long time to harvest it.
Yeah. Did you need to do, it sounds like maybe you did a little bit of playing with the adjustments. I imagine some of the air and
yeah.
Like, what else did you have to kind of mess around with?
That started at seeding time. So I was trying to figure out the drill, because you can't seed it very shallow. It's smaller than canola. So we were playing with the seeding depth, and then we played with the air. You know, we didn't have a clue. We talked around, we asked some people, but we just kind of had a hit by miss. And then we didn't exactly have the right roller, feed roller in the drill. We bought hopefully the correct one now. And we had some problems with the air blowing the seed around in the tank. It's so small and light.
It's so small.
Yeah.
But I mean, the stand ended up being pretty damn good. I can't complain.
For being our first time and not really know what we're doing, I think we got a decent stand and we know what we're doing better now.
We think.
We got the appropriate feed roller, which should help. It was hard to get a kind of an even distribution to get it to feed and seed. We were targeting 7 pounds to the acre, and I think we had some places that had 12 and some places had 3. And maybe if you averaged it out, we had 7, but I don't know if anywhere had 7 exactly. But I think next year we can get there.
Gotta love averages, though.
Yeah.
Small seeded stuff can be kind of tricky. Leon, did you get to play with the camelina adventure?
So I hauled it.
Yeah.
I didn't cut it or anything. I hauled it to Pendleton.
You got to play with the safflower adventure.
Yeah. So we did some safflower this year, and the combine plugged up, and I got to help unplug it and while the combine driver was out spraying, so he got to miss out on all those adventures that we took place. And
I'm the one that plugged it up, though.
Oh, well. Did you have some nice, like those whatever, like elbow length leather gloves for that?
No, didn't even know that it was that
you need
pokey.
Just to walk in the field, you need like a hazmat suit.
So we would have to check it to see if it was ready to cut, and just started walking out there, and it's just pokey. And
so walking through a field of cactus.
It was not ideal. So I don't know if we'll end up growing that again, but we had our adventures with it. I'm excited about the camelina, just to potentially add that extra crop rotation in. And I mean, I think it'll possibly help the farm in the long run if we can continue adding it into a crop rotation. And if the market's good, it'll benefit us all.
I think one of the biggest challenges with the camelina is going to be weed suppression or keeping it clean enough to cut, because there isn't a broadleaf herbicide that we can use after it's come out of the ground. And so your only real herbicide is just getting the plant big enough to canopy over before you get a flush of broadleaf weeds, which is difficult to do.
I think at Lind, so this is all spring planted camelina. I think at Lind Research Station, they're working on like a winter.
Mm-hmm. They are.
Yeah. Yeah. And Don Wysocki, he's helped a lot because he's done a lot of research with camelina in Pendleton.
Yeah.
And he had trials and he had pictures he showed side by side if he planted it in January, February, March. And it's extremely resilient to cold. It'll come up in 33 degree temperature soils. The problem is if you plant it in February or January, his end pictures were the January one was a field of weeds. The February was like half weeds, half camelina, and March was just camelina because you're not able to spray the weeds before they emerge. And so anything he planted in January, the camelina grew, but also all the weeds grew. And by the time it came harvest time, you couldn't even see the camelina because there was tumble mustard and, you know, every other weed and imaginable growing amongst it.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys have any issues with shatter, or were you able to get some of the variety development?
We'd waited much longer, it would have been a problem. We got in there just as a little before it became a problem.
Yeah, it did happen quick. There was, it looked all fine. And then a couple of days later, like almost 90% of the leaves were on the ground and the pods were probably going to shatter any day. So we had to like jump on it, which could be a problem if you had a lot of acres. If you had 1,000 acres of it and you have to cut it at 1 mile an hour, shattering might become an issue.
But if it works out, we might be able to get that second combine I've been talking about.
So that's one of the questions.
I keep pushing that we should get a second combine because we're kind of at that borderline with acres, but then we'd have to get another truck, get another driver. But I'm still going to push it. I'll keep putting the bug in their ear. Eventually we'll get a second.
Yeah, maybe Andre needs to make a spreadsheet.
Oh, he's got it. He's got it already. It's just going to take a little better wheat prices.
I've been there and done that, though.
Yeah.
Awesome. So do you want to talk about some? I know you guys have more experiments going on this farm this year. What else do you got going on?
So we've done a cover crop one. Well, it's still in effect. So we did a 20-acre one and then seeded over it, and then we had drought. It didn't grow anything. Well, it grew 8 bushels, I think. Maybe not even that much. And then that was a spring cover crop, so we put it in the spring and sprayed it out. And then we've come back on that field again. We expanded that to 40 acres. We overlaid it and that and some more. And we did that in the fall and then terminated it and then seeded into it this last fall. And so we'll see what that does. It looks better than the last time, so we'll see. We've done that. We've done some intercropping, a couple of different things on that. We've done wheat with peas. Didn't take them to harvest, but we did that a few times. Worked really good the first time, and then cheatgrass kind of got in the way the next time. I've done a mix. Actually, Doug Poole did it too. I got the idea from Doug Poole. Of feeding a dormant cash crop with cover crops. Let it go 1 year, and then the cover crop supposedly dies out, and then the cash crop comes. Well, it didn't quite work that way. Everything came, even after it was supposed to freeze out, and it didn't, even though it did freeze. But we tried that. Actually, the spring crop after we did that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the crops, that experiment didn't work, but the crops on that area, subsequent crops, have all been significantly better.
Yeah.
Than I think they would have been otherwise, or they're better than the other part of the field that didn't have that.
Can you describe what you mean by better? What do you see?
The yield was good.
Yeah, yield.
Yeah.
It yielded better.
No, sometimes better can be like it looked, it came up in a different way, or, looked lusher and early in the season. There's a lot of different ways that better can look. So
yeah, better on the yield map. The yield map showed. It's shown better yield, and it's cleaner too. It's been, and it might be why it's better, but there's no cheatgrass there. Last year we grew that field, it was all winter wheat, and we didn't put a grass herbicide, or we just put metribuzin on. But the side that had that experiment, no grassy weeds at all, the better yield, and the other side, some grassy weeds, a little bit lower yield.
Was this another split field, or you had it kind of paired?
It kind of was. It was a different part of the field. There was a ditch to the field. It was just 40 acres, and the rest of the field was what we normally did. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that part of any, was that like part of the Flourish project, or
no,
was
just
that
did it on
you just did on your own?
Just try it. See what happened.
Nice. Yeah. Oh, I think that guy, just because of the acreage, I think that's kind of within the scope of what the Flourish project works with, but I don't know the exact geographic bounds of the participation of the flourish at this point, but I think we'll have a podcast episode on that soon. Okay. You have also mentioned maybe some other biostimulants too.
Yeah, we did with Pivot Bio, done that a couple of times. I'll let AJ talk about that one.
We've done Pivot Bio twice. And the first time we had a plot, we did it on a spring barley. And we had a plot where we did not apply the Pivot Bio as our control. And we did see, it was extremely dry year. It was 2023.
And it was recrop.
And it was recrop spring barley in the Pendleton area. And so it didn't yield very well anywhere, but from our control to the 5 acres right next to it, there was about a 5 to 10% increase in yield. So it looked promising. So we tried it again last year on spring DNS, and it was a really wet spring. And we saw the pretty much exact opposite. So everywhere that we used, and we don't know why this happened, but everywhere we used Pivot Bio, we had worse yield, worse protein, worse test weight, pretty much worse in every way you could quantify it. We have no idea why. Everything was the same. We fertilized everything the same. The only difference was we put Pivot Bio on. And I'm not sure. This time we did Pivot Bio with a seed treat that they said was compatible. That's the only difference I can think of that we did with the spring barley is we didn't have a seed treat on the spring barley. But it's kind of a mystery. It was a 360 acre field and 150, approximately half, was in Pivot Bio. And we didn't do like just one chunk of the field with Pivot Bio. We did it separated out, so
like a strip.
Yeah, there were several different sections that had Pivot Bio and then didn't, and I could see it in the yield map. As soon as I had one pass, I'd be in the Pivot Bio pass, and then I'd turn around and the next pass I'd be in the non-Pivot Bio, and then immediately I'd see a difference in yield. You could see it visually too, and don't know what happened there, but there was something that didn't like the Pivot Bio.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Well, that's why the research community believes in replication.
Yeah.
how many years we do this doesn't give you super quick turnaround on answers, but I think allows for a little bit control of consistency. So it's interesting, though, that you got good results with it the first time and that it helped maybe with some climactic results.
Right, yeah. In an extremely dry year, it helped. In an extremely wet year, it did not. So I don't know if the climate was the reason. But
so Pivot Bio, they kind of offer like it's a synthetic biology kind of community. It's like,
it's got a living organism and you have to be careful how you treat it. Mm-hmm. And somehow it works with the other organisms and supposedly makes those organisms work to make more fertilizer, mm-hmm. more nitrogen.
Yeah. They claim like 20 pounds of N.
40 actually.
Yeah. And maybe it's because we weren't short on the field that had the DNS where we saw negative results from the biosolids had biosolids applied the year before. And so there was probably adequate N in the field. And so the bacteria may not have helped. I don't know how it hurt. That's what I'm wondering, or what it did that negatively affected it. But I could see how it wouldn't have had a positive impact, because they say if you're not deficient on N, and you may not see a yield bump or an increase in protein or something from the Pivot Bio.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. that's okay. So you did mention biosolids. So you guys work with biosolids here mm-hmm. on the farm. Do you want to talk a little bit about your trials with that?
Well, it's not really a trial. I just said, let's go up. Let's do it.
When did you start applying biosolids?
Oh, it's been four years.
2021, I think.
Years,
yeah, probably yeah. 4 years. Pretty much every acre has been applied at least once on our in Morrow County.
Yeah, there's a few of them, yeah. We just started on our couple fields this year for the second time. We got their second application. They've had three crops. Well, one of them was three crops because it was recrop. But it's all out of Portland. They truck it up here, and they spread it, do it all. They even do some soil testing to check on everything before and after, make sure we're not over applying or things are bad things are going on out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's helped with some things. I'm starting to see it in the soil tests. You know, some of our microbes are coming up. I think we're cutting our fertilizer a little bit. I haven't checked the organic matter.
It has. I've seen about a tenth improvement immediately after spreading the biosolids every time. So if we're at 1.1, we're usually at 1.2. The pH always drops a tiny bit. So we're pretty high pH, or 7.2 normal. And after the biosolids, it might drop 0.2, so 7.2 to 7, which isn't really a bad thing in our area. The micros, we did a sap analysis in 2022 on a field that had Pivot Bio and then one that did not, or sorry, getting my bios confused. One that had biosolids and one that did not. And all the micros were significantly higher on the field that had the biosolids. And then last year we spread a 20 acre field, a half section, half had biosolids and half did not. And there was almost a 10 bushel yield increase on the side with the biosolids. It was clear as day on the yield map. Just one's green and one's yellow in a big square. So it's definitely made a huge improvement, and it's allowed us to cut down a lot on the synthetic. We hardly have to put any end through the drill because we're getting it all through the biosolids.
Great. Yeah, I was wondering in your split field there, like how you calibrated if you did synthetic and like regular rate on one side, and then how you calculated the nitrogen from the biosolids. It sounds like that's part of what they
offer. So when they can't spread it without taking a sample first, because they can't over apply nitrogen, and they use like the OSU's calculation of bushels per how many, what our target yield is, and then how many nitrogen, pounds of nitrogen it would take to grow that. And so that's how they calculate their amount they're allowed to put on, and they contact us and say, how much do you want to put on? So every fall, they sample all of our fields that we're going to spread that fall, and then we adjust based on how much nitrogen is in. It's constantly changing based on the composition of the biosolids, so they'll adjust the rate based on what's in it.
Fascinating.
Make sure you don't stand downwind, though, from the field, because it's pretty bad sometimes.
Yeah, it can be smelly on a rainy day.
Yeah, and then if you got the pile real built up and then you go next to the pile, you can definitely smell it. So,
yeah, there's some pretty interesting smelling soil amendments in general. I think that's in some cases.
The Pivot Bio is a really nice smell, actually. We had it in the shop. It smells like baking bread, kind of, like it's a real yeasty.
Now, is that a liquid? Do you like run that through a sprayer, or how do you apply the Pivot Bio?
When you're treating the seed, or well, if you put treat on, it goes through a seed treat that way.
So, Leon, do you like? I imagine like this is totally why you have all the questions for these guys.
Yes, I would say there's a lot to learn. Being like, I guess my first full year into farming. You've got lots of questions, and I'm learning almost every day as I do stuff or work on stuff. And I ask a lot of questions. They probably are annoyed because of the questions I get or ask them sometimes. But I mean, if I'm doing something, I want to know why it is I'm doing it, not just, okay, I'm doing it because you told me to. I kind of want to know why we're doing it, to see where it's helping the farm in the long run, how it's improving yield or soil. Everything like that.
So what did you ask the first time the biosolids showed up?
I asked him, what is that smelly stuff you're putting on the field? And then he had to explain it a little, or he explained it to us. And then he's like, yeah. I was like, oh, okay. Well, I won't touch it.
It's called nutrient cycling. Is that closing the loop? That's the why. So actually, what did you ask why? What's the why he gave you?
Just to improve the nitrogen levels in the field, which made sense.
You guys are also working a little bit with the research community too. I know you mentioned Don.
So we've got I'm going to get the name wrong, but the Dryland Sustainable Research Project is on our place. And it's replicated up by Pendleton Research Station, but not on the station. It's another farm up there, but near it. So two different, broadly different rainfall areas. Can't tell you everything they're doing, because they're doing a lot. Because they work well in that project, they're doing different like cropping rotations, alternative crops. They're doing stuff on soil biology, fertility trials. They've done one on straw heights, measuring straw heights, and then what it does for evaporation in the soil. Kim Fallow, some of the results there, we just found out about them the other day. A little surprising. And we talked about it at a meeting with them not too long ago, and I thought, well, maybe you need to change some things, but I don't know.
Tell me more.
Well, so they did one where they took all the straw off, one about average height, and then they tried to mimic a stripper header and then run it through the Kim Fallow period and stuff. And then for the longest time, the one with all the tall straw had more moisture. But in the end, after, I don't know, May, June, somewhere in that area, or sometime in that period, I may have it wrong, but it ended up being basically the same, no matter what the straw height was. And part of it's, they think, the heat from the sun and the direction it's coming down may be an issue, negating a lot of that savings you're getting on the tall straw. And I put out there about, well, maybe you need to mow the tall straw later in the year, maybe after first spraying or something. Try that.
Yeah, that might mulch it up and kind of keep more of the moisture in.
Yeah, it was surprising to me to see that the temperature differences in the tall straw that they showed. It was significantly warmer all summer in the stripper header straw versus, which I thought it would be the opposite because it would have shaded it, but I guess the mowed or the really short stubble had a cover on it because it was kind of mulched and covering the ground completely. So that's why the differences, by the time you went to seed your next crop, the differences in moisture were equal. There wasn't a difference, at least in their studies.
I think that's similar to what Bill Schillinger actually found when he was looking at tall stubble at Lind as well. But, you know, there's the agroecologist in me wants to really think about, like, maybe there's some other advantages of having tall straw too.
And their study only went like 3 years. I said that was too short. Because they need to go a little longer. I think it would help you. Because you get wet and dry years and see what that old thing on average.
How much snow you have in the... Yeah, it's a big difference.
Yeah, I imagine so. One of the things too, again, like agroecologist hat. Do you guys have a lot of the kind of tumbling weeds like Russian thistle in this area?
I've seen that.
He has a job doing that.
So I got the contract to remove them from the fence line of the solar farm here on the land.
Awesome.
There's a lot.
That's so you get paid for that? That's cool.
Yep.
Too bad there's not like a market for them.
Well, we've been discussing trying to figure out a way to utilize them and create some sort of market, maybe fire starters or something.
Yeah,
to where we can kind of double dip as removing them and then get paid to sell them.
Yeah, sounds like great logic too. I'm still really curious the tall straw and how much that maybe would stop rolling.
Spreading of weeds,
rolling weeds in particular.
Yeah, weed suppression is another, I don't think their study looked at that too much, but if you could quantify the weed suppression in tall straw versus small straw.
Because we've talked to several people who are friends, or one of them's a really good friend of ours, but that run those, and we've asked that, and they says, "Yeah, they see a difference, but it's not quantified." Mm-hmm. He says, "But it's not that big." Mm-hmm. They think there's a smaller difference in like weed suppression, and then the other thing was the moisture thing, and they all claim they get more moisture from it, which I believe they do, and the study kind of indicated their moisture was better up to a point, and then it all just leveled out the same.
You guys also mentioned the solar farm. Are these part of your farm, the alternative energy?
So we have wind and solar on the place. And it was recently the biggest one in North America of combined wind, solar, and battery storage. I mean, I think there's another project bigger now.
Wow. Has that been its own on-farm trial?
Kind of. Out of farm around the dang thing. I mean,
That's hit a lot of fences.
Well, the Russian thistle, maybe you should leave the Russian thistle. It'll just provide a little buffer pad or something.
So for the first year and a half or better, the thistles got pretty big buying them. We thought they were going to blow the fence over. They do a good job of catching it. not ours. I had Leon in mind. It's like, here's a job for you. Uh-huh. Get a contract with them. And it's worked out. So, but yeah, they catch a lot of Russian thistle. I mean, and it's been a challenge. It doesn't make, we had nice fields where really economic to farm, you know. I mean, just straight, boom, 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 you're done, you know. Nice square or rectangle. Well, now it's a dang jigsaw puzzle, and you got to watch out for an eight-foot fence you got to hit. I hit one the seeding this year for the first time and took out three posts. So. And Andre's hit it with a sprayer.
Yeah, I've had some fun there.
Yeah. It's part of what happens with sprayers, though, kind of, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, we have, I don't know how many miles of fence to spray around now with the solar panel. Yeah. So it's inevitable you're probably going to hit one at some point. Or you come back with, you have to leave a big gap, and then you come back with a four-wheeler to...
Yeah, I do that. Enough.
So, yeah, the efficiencies of farming around them are not very great.
Hopefully it pays off in other ways.
It does.
Yeah. So you got fence there you have to farm around anyway. Can you put cows in there?
No.
Inside?
Yeah.
No, they would tear up. I know they've done it with sheep, but even they've torn it up too much. They've eaten some of the wiring. Hmm. But cows would probably just destroy everything because they leaned on them.
So farming around the solar fencing, or the fencing around the solar field, but then you're also farming around windmills too?
Yeah. Those are a lot easier, but even they take out some of the efficiencies. I've learned that the first time I was spraying the field. I had a rectangle field. Now you got this road through the middle of it, and even with, you know, section control and stuff shutting it off, you still end up with more turning and stuff eventually.
Yeah, it's way less efficient to seed. There's way more overlap. We probably added 2-3% overlap in some fields just because of how you have to seed it.
But they are easier than solar to farm around.
And we have nice roads. When it comes harvest time, your trucks have nice roads. So there's definitely some benefits. The solar farms are much, or winter farms are much easier to work with.
Nice. So you mentioned the sectional control on your sprayer. Are you doing a lot with precision application?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, we've got weed it, and we've got a CN spray on. Got to weed it on a Miller sprayer and a CN spray on actually two different John Deere's. Or no, one CN spray and one's an older John Deere with a weed it too. So we've got those. We've got section control. We've upgraded some of those to be more sections. We've taken our air drill. Actually, Andre's probably wants to talk about this. I used to be the tech guy until he came along. It's yours. Huh. But, so I'll let him go from there.
Okay. What's the difference between the CN spray and the Weed It for you?
Well, we've only demoed a CN spray, so I haven't really experienced it too much. Just the technology and how they do them is completely different. One's using a laser to detect chlorophyll, and one's using an actual RGB camera to see a weed and then spray it. I was kind of hesitant to go with the CN spray because of dust. You have to have a visual line of sight where the weed it you don't. And we're so dry in that time of year when we're using it in July and August. But other people that have run a CN spray haven't seen too many issues with the dust. So I'm hoping that won't be an issue. Just the way it integrates is much easier with the CN spray. And the upfront cost was really the biggest thing that got us to buy a CN. You can install it. We got a PUC, which is a precision upgrade kit that John Deere offered, and the cost of installing that on your sprayer is maybe 1/10, or not maybe 1/8.
Something.
Well, you know, it's about $30,000 versus $170,000. So it's quite a bit cheaper to install it. There is a cost to run it. John Deere costs you it charges you $1 an acre to run the machine, but we did the math, and we could run it for like 15 years before we would break even with the Weed It. So that was the big thing that pushed us to getting a CN spray, was the cost. And then just the way it integrates is much easier to use and friendlier than the Weed It, because it's all in one system. It's a lot more streamlined. It looks a lot cleaner. If you went and looked at our CN sprayer, you may not even notice that it has that technology on it. It just looks like a normal sprayer, but has cameras that are embedded that you hardly even see. Which are pretty cool, but we'll see when we actually run both side by side the efficacy of one compared to the other. We only demoed a CN spray a few years ago, and it seemed to work great, but that was also in May when it wasn't really dusty, so we're going to find out.
It worked great till we got to the airport.
Yeah, we found a
I started having issues with it, and I was out fixing nozzles and trying to, they kept acting up. And finally, in the last hour, I called him and says, you come get this damn thing. It's like, I hate it. Well, it turns out the radar was screwing up the scene spray.
And what? It
took, yeah. The radar was screwing it up, the electronics on it, and because we ran it in a field a long ways away, and then we ran it at the airport, Pendleton Airport. They said they spent 2 weeks and finally found a patch and built a patch to fix that. So we found something they didn't know. So.
Well, look at you innovating.
Yeah, good beta testers. Yeah. Good at finding defects.
Oh, man. How long have you guys been running your weed at?
Oh, gosh. How long?
2021. So 4 years.
Is that what it was? Well, before that, I had a weed seeker years before, and it worked and did really well. That's how I knew these would work out, but it wasn't very reliable in the end. It had a lot of issues electronically. They'd act up. And so I finally gave up on it after about 3 years.
There's too many gremlins.
Yeah. They've come out with a new one. I think it's a lot better now. And then we kind of ran in the desert for a while until the weed seeker showed up, and then we went with that route. So.
There's mixed feelings sometimes about the weed it. Do you have any best practices with the weed?
Yeah, I think it depends on it. So the man hours are going to be way higher if you're running a weed it, and I guess it's how much are you are going to tolerate. How many passes are you willing to tolerate is the question I'd ask. But we found our kind of special mix is to do two broadcast sprays in the spring and then go with the weed it. The first year we ran it with one broadcast spray and then just straight weed it. And we did 4 to 5 passes with the weed it after that first one. And we do 4 to 5,000 acres of fallow. So trying to manage that is a lot of man hours. So if you're able to tolerate that, it's still cheaper in the long run. You're using a lot less chemical, a lot less water. It's more hours on your sprayer, and it's more hours for a man to be in the sprayer. So
you can drive faster.
We can't drive very fast with the weed it because of dust, at least in our area. We're going about 7 miles an hour. Usually, so it's kind of slow. You don't have to stop to refill, so you're still pretty efficient. You're still getting a lot done in a day. But yeah, I think it's a question of how much are you willing to sit on your sprayer and you know, with two broadcast passes, you might only need 2 weed it passes after that. Maybe 3, sometimes more, but you're 2 to 3. So you're saving time. But the weed it passed we found cost $2 to $3 an acre to run. So you can do a lot of weed it spraying before you to one broadcast spray for it to pencil out.
Now, do you do the thing where you mix up your chemical rotation because you're using less of the herbicide? I hear somewhat. That you can...
We've tried different, a whole bunch of different mixes. We've talked to several farmers. They'll do the same thing. And I don't think anybody's got a 100% correct one, but we've got one. Kind of use for the most part, and it's especially later in the season. We put Rivington in with Roundup, mainly those two, maybe MSO, and then sometimes some broadleaf. I've tried that as an on and off, and I don't know if it probably burns it down quicker and makes it look better, but the Rivington Roundups work pretty well.
Yeah, Rivington or Sharpen, whatever we can get our hands on. Those through the weed have been really effective. And it's chemicals that I don't think we'd use without a weed it. Mm-hmm. They're just too expensive, and you'd have to use too high of a rate to be effective.
Yeah, I hear that's like another kind of bonus cool thing about the precision.
Because we were doing that by acre. Oh, my God.
it'd be very expensive. It's $900 a gallon. It's up quick.
Yeah, especially with quite a lot of fallow, it sounds like.
We've gone, you know, if we were broadcast spraying, we'd be doing like 10 gallons an acre. But now we're up there, we're putting on anywhere from 18 to 22, 24 gallons an acre, one that nozzles on. But per acre, we've been down to as low as 3/4 of a gallon, at least.
Yeah.
Normal is about 1.5 per acre, so.
That sounds like a win. That's a good reduction.
Yeah. It's just the time.
And it's less water. And water's a big thing around here, because Dad always said whiskey's cheaper than water, and he's right. Because there ain't a lot of water in this area under the ground either. So.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the most expensive fluid on the planet is printer ink. I'm not sure if that's like accurate or not, but It was an interesting
bit of chemicals that got to be pushing that very close.
I don't know. There was some RNA-free water that we got for a microbial analysis in the lab. That stuff was not cheap. So what's the most interesting thing you've learned from a past trial?
Most interesting thing.
I don't like walking in safflower. That's
safflower chaff is like you. I think you really have to have some very significant incentive to want to grow safflower.
Yeah. It looks pretty for a little bit, but
yeah, they use it in the floral industry actually.
Some of the things that probably had some of the bigger impacts are things we've actually did ourselves. There are things we had done on the farm through our extension agent. One was a zinc trial, and we've actually added zinc to, and that's how we got down this road. Kind of the first step we took on the soil health thing was looking at the micronutrient zinc, and through some of his work, we started adding that in. And the other one was one I got through reading the Oregon Farmer Stockman, and I read about this Colorado wheat, that's red wheat. And so I told my extension agent, can you get some of the seed? And lo and behold, he managed to wrangle some out from Colorado. And it was a Brawl red wheat. It was a Clearfield variety. And he got one or two others. And they put them in plots not only in our place and other places. And that actually had a big impact. That was a pretty big wheat grown here for quite a while. It's died out some because of stripe rust. But, well, we've got several hundred acres of left here. But because of those trials, a lot of farmers switched to that red wheat. There was a lot of it grown here. And there's still some. It's not near what it was because of stripe rust. But, and we're back to growing again because the coaxium red wheats aren't quite what we want them to. So we went back to the Brawl. But that had a big impact countywide.
That's cool. That definitely sounds like an interesting trial and an adventure in innovation.
Yeah. On the others, I don't know. Probably the ones that fall flat in your face. I don't know what was one.
Ooh, that brings me to this question here. Can you tell me about the most memorable time when you experienced unintended consequences from a trial and how you moved on with the information from that experience?
Well, one was the one where we did the cash crop with the cover crop together and what it did afterwards. Now, we didn't really follow up on that, but the year we did it and stuff was a failure from what we thought it would do. But the year after when we put another crop in, that was a surprise. The cover crop thing, because everybody's been pushing that. I still don't know if it's going to work here. It's interesting to try, and and some of the crops we've grown for cover crops have, kind of pretty and they grow. And some of them I've actually grown for cash and some of them I haven't. It's interesting to make you think outside the box, what can we do with this? And I'm still debating that. Because I've known guys, we could do maybe two cash crops together and separate them out.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't done that yet. It might be interesting, but it's a lot of labor and expense to get into that. But it does make you think outside the box, where could this go?
I don't believe in a box.
Yeah, circle. I don't know. Whatever.
just there's no limits. Yeah. So I know you mentioned you've done some interseeding. Do you want to piggyback on that, Andre?
Sure. So we've done, I'm sure my dad's done more than this, but recently what we've done is interseeded peas with wheat. We've done that three different years. And then we also tried, last year we did radish with winter wheat. The peas with wheat were just to add diversity. It was kind of and maybe sequester nitrogen with winter wheat. So we put in Austrian winter pea with winter wheat at a couple pounds to the acre. And the first year it did seem to, and we did this over the entire field. I don't have a way to perfectly say if it impacted the yield, but it did seem to benefit it. That field was a little bit higher than the fields near it. There wasn't any negative impact, I guess, we could see. And in a 9-inch rainfall, if we could have two crops growing at the same time without a negative impact, that's pretty cool. The peas, because we're spraying a broadleaf herbicide, most of them are dead. We're not harvesting 99% of them. A few make it through. But it did seem to have an impact the first year. The second year, my dad mentioned we had a lot of cheatgrass, and we had to put down, we put down Olympus, I believe it was, in the fall. And that killed a lot of the peas before they really got established. And that field just never looked that great through the rest of the year. So we didn't get good data the second time. And the third time we did it in Pendleton. And it was kind of the same story as the first year, where I didn't see, you couldn't tell on the yield map where I had the peas and where I didn't have the peas. So we had a crop growing the entire year. That year we seeded at a little higher rate. It's maybe 3 to 4 pounds. I don't remember exactly, but we had 3 to 4 pounds of peas growing with our winter wheat. And you couldn't tell where the peas were on the yield map. So there's something, we're getting some diversity without a yield drag at all. So I think there is, it's hard to quantify if that's going to pencil out in the long run, but I do think there's some promise there.
So it sounds like something you might try again.
Yeah, possibly.
Possibly.
And then the radish, we were trying to break up compaction, which in theory, I think is something I would try again, but it didn't really work as what we were intending it to do. It didn't really happen. Most of the radishes died over the winter. And then a lot of them, most of them died when we sprayed as well in the spring. And so very few got large enough to actually break out compaction. So I would see little pockets where I'd find 4 or 5 radishes and they'd have a little bit of a tuber, and maybe that had an impact. But I think we'd have to maybe seed earlier or have better conditions when we're seeding to make that pay off.
How do you decide where to put your trials?
Probably just wherever it's easy to get to, or whatever looks like a nice spot.
Right outside your front yeah. door in the
yeah.
window?
Yeah, we have flags right in front of the window.
Yeah, so we do. We have a bunch right out the door. So
you can see them every day really easily.
It's just kind of, you know, what's going to fit the farm around it. It's kind of what it is. Or,
yeah.
So how do you mark and like kind of keep track of where you're putting these different trials? Because it sounds like you have a lot going on in the farm kind of at any given time. How do you keep track of it?
Yeah, because we've got Oregon State University's got their variety trials right outside the door. And then we've got our own little 1 acre plots of different crops. I'll let AJ talk about that. We just flag them out.
Yeah, I mean, most of it's just gone through the John Deere in my operations center. We're not always 100% perfect with that, but usually if the person doing it is paying attention, they can label everything on my ops, on the tractor, on the sprayer, or whatever they're doing, and then it will be uploaded to the my operations center, and we can track it that way. And then you can take it back to the yield map and overlay the two maps and see.
Okay. Nice. So no, like, archive of written notebooks? And
no, I had that 20-some years ago. I did that. I wish I kept all that, because I did a whole bunch of notes on different crops and what I seeded, what I sprayed, what they yielded. That would sure come in handy now. And I threw them all away. I sat there for 10 years or better, taking up space, like, chuck it. Should have kept them.
We've recently got every piece of equipment with a MTG, so telematics unit, so everything we do is automatically, instantly in the cloud. So it's very convenient. There's no having to keep track of paperwork or anything. And any operation we do is automatically in the operations center and stays there.
Sounds like you get a gold star as the tech guy.
Yeah. wasn't too bad, just money.
There's that part, isn't there? Well, hopefully in the long run it saves. So how do you determine the ROI on a new practice and determining whether it's worth, something's worth doing? Sounds like spreadsheets are part of that.
Pretty much it.
Yeah.
I let him make a spreadsheet on it, and I look at it like, oh, crap. Or, oh, that was good.
Well, what do you track in the spreadsheet? Is it just dollars, or do you track, like, the person hours or whatever?
No, direct and indirect costs, usually. Trying to get a cost per acre and then the revenue. And, yeah, it's the basic. It's not too complex. It's all the direct. I try to break it down by a direct and indirect cost is the main thing. I put every cost in there, and then which are incremental to that acre and which are distributed amongst the farm. Like, you know, equipment insurance is an indirect cost. It's distributed amongst all of the ground. So it's a way that you can measure if a piece of ground is profitable. Because a piece of ground might look not profitable, but if you're covering some of your indirect costs, if you're distributing that now over a larger acre, it's actually, you know, you have to look at it a different way to determine if one piece of ground is profitable compared to everything else.
Some finesse of dry land farming for you. I might have kind of already asked this, but how do you decide whether you're going to try something again?
Some of it's stuff he comes up with out of the air. I don't know. Some of it's just reading research stuff. One I just got off. Where the heck did I run into it? Faba beans. I might try some faba beans, at least in a cover crop or something. I was just reading about, it was on TV is where I saw it. And they could grow in the winter, take down to 10 degrees temperature, and like, okay. There's probably not a market for them here, but first can I grow it? Doesn't matter if there's a market. Let's see if I can grow it. And we'll figure out a market later. But it's like, that's something maybe. It's a huge nitrogen fixer. It's something totally different. And on top of that, there are several chemicals, a few of them, that we already use, we can use on it. So, okay, weed management. Because that's cereals is one thing, but you go into broadleaves, these other crops, weed management's probably the driving factor to keep you from growing it. Then rain, when you get down to it. So it's trying to figure out what fits that we can do, that we know how to do. And so that's one of the things I look at. And then, I just find things from reading or talking to other farmers, what they're doing, or go to concert conferences like Direct Seed Conference or things like that.
Listening to podcasts.
Yeah, that too. That's actually right. I've listened to Doug Poole and what some of things done on your podcast. And it's like, we've tried them or we're going to try them. So.
I appreciate that little shout out. I was being a little tongue-in-cheek, but thank you. No. So what's the most fun thing about trying stuff on the farm?
It's just something different, I guess. Growing winter wheat over and over again on summer fallow can get a little boring.
I'll agree with that.
So it's fun to grow a different crop and learn about a different crop and see, learn the intricacies of every different thing. And I also like, last year I bought a mill, I don't remember what you call it, an oil press, and we grew safflower and camelina. So I got to try making some, you can see a jar of it over there, some of our own camelina oil. And I also have a mill, so we grew durum last year and I got to make pasta, and getting to use the end products at home and having more than just soft white winter wheat over and over again is a lot of fun. And that's kind of what pushed me to want to do durum last year, is I had Ryan Grabner from OSU gave me a bag of durum seed, and I made pasta at home and I really loved it. But then I looked up how much it cost to buy durum, and I'm like, holy cow, it's extremely expensive.
Because so, you've got a farm right here.
Yeah, so we bought a couple buckets off of Amazon and grew 1 acre of durum and ended up with more durum than I could use in 10 lifetimes. So I sold a lot of it through Facebook, and then I have enough that I can make pasta every day for years. But it's fun to get to use different products at home that we grew on the farm.
So I kind of took that and says, how can we add that value to the farm and make money out of it? So we're kind of looking at that. I've talked to some different people, done some reading. We've talked about what products, and we're working on it. It's like looking at cost. If we go a little bigger mill, if we do this, we're kind of researching. It's like, I think it might be a way to, it's not going to be all over the whole farm. If it's 10 acres, hey, it's 10 acres. Mm-hmm. And then some different types of crops. You've got kumut, the ancient grain. Put it out here. And it's like, there's some markets for that. And it's totally different. We've got some perennial wheat. We started out with 12 ounces. I had OSU help build up the seed for us. And we've got 1 acre of it this year. Maybe that's something, we don't have to replant the wheat. I don't know how well it's going to work. We'll see. But it's good for 3 to 5 years, just like an annual crop. So we'll see.
Have you guys seen, I think the Land Institute partnered with like Patagonia or something to make this like carbon farmer beer.
Oh, Kernza?
Yeah.
Yeah. From Ashland. Yeah, I've tried that.
Have you had it?
Yeah, it's good.
Awesome.
It's
good. I haven't had it, but man, if I see it, I'm going to snap it right up. but it's kind of fun to see that kind of market too, where, even just the name of the beer, right? It's Carbon Farmer, isn't it?
I think it's called Kernza, the one that I'm thinking of. It's about Caldera Brewing, and there's probably more than one. The one I know of is made by Caldera Brewing. It's a blue can.
Maybe it's the same one. But anyway, it's fun to get, when there is space to be made for that kind of value add.
So. Yeah.
No, that's fun to hear about Andre's special pasta, too.
It tastes better when you grow it yourself.
Yeah.
It does pancake mix, too. So.
Yeah. But mainly we had too much Durum. We got 3,000 pounds or so of Durum.
It yielded really well.
Yeah, that was a big surprise.
I grew it several years ago, and it didn't yield anything like that. I mean, the varieties, and then the mill quit taking Durum after 2 years, so it's not that
different. Yeah, we were over 40. It was 1 acre, like 1.2 acres, but it was over 40 bushels an acre. I had 50-some bushels of Durum, which I can't use myself, but you don't realize how much a bushel of wheat is until you're milling it and using it yourself.
Yeah, it's a different equation when it kind of moves from commodity to food.
Right, right.
Especially that you're using in your kitchen.
Yeah. So I was selling the Durum online, and I think there is definitely a market for, there's a lot of people that wanted it in Pendleton, and I think there's a big market for that of selling grains directly to consumer. And there's a lot more consumers that are milling in their own home. And I think whole milled grains are amazing, but they're not shelf stable. And this is kind of maybe a solution to that, is if you mill it in your own home, and so you buy the grain, and grain in itself, if stored correctly, is shelf stable. I think they say it's 5 years, but that's because they can't stay longer than 5 years. But it's really, it's like honey; it can store forever. And so I think that's a really good market, and something that we can do pretty easily is sell whole grains to consumers. And that's why we have all these plots in front of our house with hard white wheat, kumut, perennial wheat, a bunch of different Durum.
Yeah, it's neat to see different farmers around different parts of the region that are really exploring the cropping diversification and then seeking the markets for the value add, especially when, soil health is such a priority on the farm and the stewardship aspect, and trying to grow more nutritious crops that maybe have more micronutrients in them and that sort of thing. So it's fun to see maybe more momentum growing in that space.
Yeah.
And hopefully the consumer side can match with that.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's a totally different experience when you have like really freshly milled grain.
Right.
That's great. So what's the most annoying thing about trying stuff on the farm?
Time.
Yeah. Yeah, filling up the drill to seed 1 acre with a 60-foot drill. You climb up there and dump the seed out, and then in 20 seconds you're empty and you got to do it again. And yeah, it's definitely takes a lot more time. That 1 acre of Durum was our most profitable acre, but I guarantee I spent way more time on that 1 acre than I did any other 10 acres.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is the biggest barrier to trying things on the farm?
Education and money can be. And the time commitment. When you're trying to get over all the other acres and you want to spend the time for that, but then it's going to take a little bit more money, actually maybe a lot more money, I don't know, on some of these things. And then you got to spend time learning, which I don't know. I mean, that's a good thing. Actually, I like that, but it does take time. I don't know if we call it a barrier, but you do have to learn it. So those are probably the three things I can think of.
Yeah, I agree. The time and money. Like we have equipment, we have rent to pay, we have equipment payments to make. We can't afford to fail too much, and so we have to keep a certain amount of acres where we know we're going to make some money. And then just the time, we're 9-inch rainfall, which I said, which means we have a lot of acres, which means time is short certain parts of the year. So
mm-hmm. Well, and do you have kids, Andre?
Yeah, I have one.
Yeah,
3-year-old.
Do they like to farm?
I don't know. She's
there. She likes to come to the farm.
She likes to watch Gabby's Dollhouse and read books.
But does she ride with you on the tractor?
Yeah.
Is she doing that?
Yeah.
It's part of growing up a farm kid. Nice. No,
yeah, Leon's got two, also three and a 1 year old, 1.5 year old. They're the same way. I mean, they like, and they live on the farm, and they like the same thing. They like to ride. They like to look at it, especially the 1 year old. He's like, you see a tractor, he's like, oh, but they all kids do that.
Chris, how did you get into kind of becoming interested in on-farm trials in general? Like, do you come from the legacy of people who try things on the farm?
We didn't grow up with a lot of that. I mean, be honest with you, but my dad was always encouraging. At that time, we were a trashy fellow and stuff, and he just kind of encouraged, you know, look at different varieties. And you never put all your eggs in one basket, is what he said. And so that kind of got it started. And then, you know, when technology started coming along, he was all for it. He said, give it a shot. He just told me, he says, remember, if you put crap in, that's what you're going to get out. And I just kind of ran with it and started trying not only new technologies, but new crops, wanted to stay on the cutting edge and just be ahead of the ball game. It's kind of what I always wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And I find it fascinating. I like to learn stuff. That's kind of cool. So,
do you have any perspective to add to that, Andre?
I agree. It's fun to learn things. It's fun to try new things. And yeah. Oh. I don't think it'd be boring to do the same thing over and over again, even if it worked. Even if it made more money, I'd still want to try something. I'd still experiment in some way.
Yeah. What would you guys try if you had like no limits? Is there like one thing that you're like, man, I really want to try that thing, but
different drills, mm-hmm. like even a less disturbance drill would be one. Trying to think of crops or something. Well, we're looking at the biologicals aspect, and there are some biologicals, and what I want to get more into that and figure that out a little bit more for the soil health thing, but also crop wise, you know, I don't know if it's going to make a, you know, boom difference. We grow 10 more bushels in an acre. I'm hoping there's some increase. And those are not cheap, some of them. So it's like, I want to try some of those things. Andre, what do you think?
Maybe annual cropping with several different, if I have no limits, which means I have no limits on manpower, annual cropping everything on the farm with different crops, you know, a mix of barley and wheat and camelina and oats and things that we know that do work. There's a mix that I think could work in an annual crop year. It's just, one, it's not as stable. We've seen annual cropping here, you get way larger variance in yield. It can be 2 or it could be 50. And then the time, if I was going to seed every acre and harvest every acre every year, we don't have the equipment or the manpower to do so. So, but if you give me unlimited resources, that's something I think would be triable.
That was the question. So if you could ask like a scientist a question right now, like your kind of one of your core research questions for your farm, what would that be for each of you? I mean, you kind of already get the chance to do that. It sounds like you work with the research community already pretty closely. Yeah. So maybe you already have, but like, what's your kind of core research?
You know, I don't know if I have a question. We listened to Joel Williams, and it's at the Soil Health Day up in Tri-Cities here recently, or I did. And I was always in earth science. This is what I took a lot of. And I was really amazed at all the studies and what they know about a plant and the soil and how they interact. I was like, I was never into biology and stuff like that, but it's like pretty cool. I mean, it's pretty amazing what they've learned and how those microbes and when you feed that plant and what it sends down to that root and what that root's telling the soil around it and the world around all that and how they interact. That's pretty amazing. I was like, how do they learn that?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Because it's so dang microscopic, some of it. It's like, I'm just amazed people could figure that out.
It's hard to answer. The thing that comes to mind is nutrient density in different varieties of wheat and different type. What impacts our farming practices have on the nutrient density of the end crop. And it's one of the things that really surprised me when I first came back to the farm and was learning about how they conduct the grain trials, is that nutrient density isn't measured at all.
Okay.
You're measuring protein and yield and disease tolerance and other things. And I'm not saying they're not doing a great job. It would be extremely hard to do, but we're growing a food. Like, nutrients should be a core value that's looked at in all variety trials, in my opinion. And then farmers can be incentivized to grow higher nutrient density varieties. I'd want to know what differences there are between the varieties, and then what differences our farming practices have on the density of nutrients between the varieties.
See, he comes in with a much younger professional perspective, because I'm stuck in some of the old school of yield and stuff. I know where he's coming from, and he's right. And that's kind of what this regenerative ag movement is feeding that plant, feeding that soil. And even that, I learned that feeding that soil and stuff isn't necessarily looking, just doing stuff in the soil. It's feeding that plant through the roots. And I kind of was an aha moment, I guess. And it's like, oh, okay. I've been looking at only half the story. And what he's talking about, it's like, it's going to be easier for him to make that transition than guys like me, because we're kind of stuck in the past, maybe a little too much. Even though we try not to be, we still are.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what I'm hearing from this conversation.
Well, I know where my roots came from, and I know where I've been stuck in, so.
Yeah. Well, do you guys have any final thoughts here as we wrap up? Any, like, pearls of wisdom for cropping systems innovation for the region?
Don't go broke. That's a good one.
Yeah, no, that is a good one.
Don't be afraid to learn, and don't be afraid to talk to your neighbors or read a book and research things and try them out. You know, it might be 1 acre. Just do even 1 acre. Do something. Plant something bizarre. Do some fertility thing. Do something. And try to keep track of what you did and maybe expand on it. I mean, it's kind of how I got going.
Yeah, try something new every year. Try something you haven't done before. It can be really small, but it's easy to do, and you're going to learn something every time.
Great. Well, this has been a really wonderful conversation. Thank you both so much for participating in the On Farm Trials podcast and sharing your experience and your journey along the way.
We've got one more question you didn't ask.
Oh, what's that?
Who do I going to throw under the tractor in the next podcast?
Oh, of course.
So I got two for you.
Thank you.
So one is, and maybe you've already talked to him, I don't know, Larry Lucher, County Extension Agent. He's done a lot of on-farm stuff with farmers. He's had an impact in this county, the things he's done as far as varieties and fertility. And weed management, we've actually incorporated several things. One he's working on right now with weed management stuff in fallow. And Andre here has actually kind of run with the ball, and we're starting to implement some of those changes. And the other one, it's not really a person, but I would take the drive down and go do one at the Wheat Marketing Center. Because that's funded by dollars, all from growers from all the Pacific Northwest and several other states. And it may not be on-farm research, per se, but it's where a lot of our dollars go, and I think people would find that an interesting story.
Ooh. Well, thank you for the inspiration. Do you want to nominate anyone, Andre?
Nope, you got your hands full.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kara.
As always, a big thank you to our guests today for sharing their wealth of knowledge and experience with us. This podcast is produced by the PNW Farmers Network team with music credit to Carlos Flores. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers alone and do not represent that of the PNW Farmers Network or any associated agencies. Please remember that experimental results will vary, and listeners are encouraged to try things at home. If you like what you heard, please support this work by sharing, rating, and reviewing. And do consider joining us as a guest or nominating a friend who is trying things on their farm. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, happy trials.